From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 7 blazing months, presidential candidate Howard Dean went from no-name long shot to soaring frontrunner to, after defeat in the Iowa caucuses and the infamous scream, Democratic also ran. In the end, despite months of dizzyingly high poll numbers and fundraising totals around the country, Dean won only one primary in his home state of Vermont. And yet, his impact on this campaign season has been profound. He was the first candidate to forcefully criticize the war in Iraq, showing other Democrats they could win points by battling Republicans on foreign policy. He was the first candidate to fully harness the power of the Internet for raising money, bringing in close to $40 million online and convincing John Kerry and others to focus more of their efforts on getting small online contributions. And Dean was the first candidate in the race to aggressively pursue grassroots organizing, convincing thousands of volunteers to put their lives on hold to join his campaign for the White House. Tonight on Point, former Vermont governor and presidential candidate Howard Dean on the war in Iraq, the future of the Democratic Party, and what John Kerry needs to do to win in November. Then later in this hour, we'll hear from The New Yorker's George Packer on Kirkuk, a potential trigger for civil war in Iraq. But first, my conversation taped earlier today with former Vermont Governor Howard Dean. Howard Dean, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be on. Thanks very much, Tom.
So here you are. You've got a new book out. You're back in the public eye, but not the way you planned. What's it like? What's it been like to watch the home stretch of this presidential race from the sidelines, Howard Dean?
Well, it's exciting. I mean, I was doing everything I can to help John Kerry win. I think that things look reasonably good. Everybody's working hard, and 5 weeks to go. I mean, hopefully we're going to change the country back to the way it ought to be.
Back to the way it ought to be. That was your theme during the campaign. Has it been John Kerry's theme? Do you see him carrying the torch that you lit?
I think the differences between me and John Kerry are very, very small compared to the differences between either of us and George Bush. You know, George Bush doesn't balance budgets. We have the biggest deficit in the history of the country. John Kerry has a history of voting for balanced budgets. George Bush has made an incredible mess of our foreign policy. That's one of John Kerry's great strengths. George Bush has attacked the environment. John Kerry has been a longtime defender of the environment. So it's very clear to me there's a huge qualitative difference between these two people, and I think one is very suited to be president of the United States, and one clearly has shown in the last 4 years that he is not.
And yet, you've seen the polls like all the rest of it. It was neck and neck for a long time, and now George Bush has pulled ahead. Let me ask you a question, Governor Dean. It's widely perceived that Democratic primary voters voted for the electable candidate in choosing John Kerry rather than Howard Dean, who they'd had quite a romance with until Election Day. Do you think Democratic primary voters made a mistake in going for what they assumed was the electable candidate?
No, I think John Kerry is going to be very electable, and not only that, I think he's going to get elected. I think people don't understand, and the media hasn't written much about, what the real dynamic in elections like this are. In elections where the president's running for re-election, 1996 was a good example, too. There are two questions, not one. Usually it's which guy do you want, which person do you want one of these days. But in a year like 2004 or 1996, it's first, do you think the president's doing a good enough job to get reelected? With Bill Clinton in 96, they said yes, and that was the end of Bob Dole. He never got into the game. With George Bush, the answer is no. If you look at every poll, the one thing they have in common, some have Bush way up, some have it a tie, but the one thing they have in common is they think the country's going in the wrong direction by a wide margin. People do not want to rehire this president. The next question is, can John Kerry fill the shoes of the presidency? That's the question that people haven't answered yet, and they're not going to answer it until we have 2 weeks or even 2 days to go. That's why the debates are so important, not because it's going to be a fight between John Kerry and George Bush, but because John Kerry has the first chance since the end of July to make his case directly to the American people.
Howard Dean, you've written in the new book, You Have the Power. You say, if we're going to win this election and keep on winning elections, that is Democrats in the future, we have to live up to our purpose and our mission as the authentic party of the American people. We have to radically transform ourselves if we want to be able to reunite, re-empower, and restore America. Is this what John Kerry is about? Is this what he's doing in Howard Dean's terms?
Well, John Kerry has said that we would have health insurance for virtually every American. Now, that's about 50 years overdue, but that's definitely part of the classical Democratic agenda. We shouldn't be ashamed of that. It's not some socialist plot. Every other country in the industrial world has it, and we should too. John Kerry has the old-fashioned notion that you ought to balance budgets. That's kind of radical considering what we've seen from this administration, which is borrow and spend and borrow and spend. John Kerry believes that you ought to respect other nations before you make foreign policy decisions that are not so good for you or for them. A radical notion in this administration, which hadn't given a damn what the rest of the world thought. And now we're paying a big price for that. So I'm not sure I'd call John Kerry's presidency radical, but it is a return to a normal American leadership relationship with the rest of the world, and I think that's a good thing.
Does it begin to address the Dean agenda?
Yeah. If it didn't, I wouldn't be supporting him.
Does it begin to grasp the scale of it? I mean, again and again in your book, you're laying out a real transformative change in the Democratic Party. You say you've got to get out there and compete at every level, be involved in a whole new way, take all the gloves off, don't try and work the middle like Bill Clinton did. He was unique in his capacity to do that. You're saying don't do that. Is that what's underway here or not?
It is in a certain way. You've got to look at the policy. Politics is important, but policy is more important. John Kerry's policies are great for America. Universal health care, an environmental approach, which includes huge dependence on renewable energy to get us off oil, to deal with global warming. Global warming is a word that the Bush administration is not even allowed to use. I mean, this is anti-science, know-nothingism that's going on here in Washington. And so from that point of view, yeah, I think John Kerry will actually run a fact-based administration instead of an ideology-based administration, and that's what we need.
You're very critical of George Bush, talking about him surrounding himself with radical ideologues and extremists. You say he's polluted our government institutions with fundamentalist bigotry. But you are very critical of Democrats as well. You say even more infuriating was the way my fellow Democrats went along for the ride. Is the Democratic Party still along for that ride? Or has your Democratic wing of the Democratic Party come back to the middle of the party?
Well, I think we're very much stronger than we were. And we do have 1,000 candidates running for office, one of whom has already won. We managed to dispose of the woman who invented the butterfly ballots in Palm Beach County, Florida, with a wonderful candidate named Dr. Arthur Anderson, who is a school board member. We've got a great lawyer running against Tom DeLay, who is only 8 points behind in Houston. So we are making some headway. Of course, we're not going to know how much headway we made until November 2nd, but we really are, because of organization, making headway, and we can do a lot more. We've had 5 months to set up this organization, and with more time, we're going to do more.
I want to talk about Iraq for a minute. It's emerged as what may be the central issue in this campaign. You and John Kerry were on opposite sides of the Iraq resolution question all through the primary. John Kerry attacked you later on for saying that capturing Saddam Hussein did not make the United States safer. Let me ask you first, the question President Bush is likely to put to John Kerry tomorrow night is, would we have been better off with Saddam Hussein still in power? How would you have answered that? How should John Kerry answer it?
I think the jury is still out, but it's unfortunately looking more and more like the Iraqis are worse off now than they were. Saddam Hussein was dreadful. He killed 300,000 of his own people. He was a terrible person, and I'm glad he is gone. But we now face an Iraq that was no danger to the United States. The 9/11 Commission has said so. We now face an Iraq that is a danger to the United States because al-Qaeda is there. They were not there before. Because they're incredible, they're almost a failed nation state, because there's likely to be a civil war or a Shiite theocracy, neither of which is good for the United States. So from the American point of view, Saddam presented a stability that was not threatening to America, dreadful that he was. Now, the question is, can we resurrect Iraq? And I think the increasing evidence is that the president has botched this to such a degree that we may end up with a worse situation than we had before.
So if John Kerry is asked, as he often is, you know, what next? What would he do in Iraq? What's the answer that Howard Dean, would like to hear?
He's already said what he thinks, and I agree with him. He has said that the troops will come out within his first term, and I think that's the right thing to do. And he has said that he'll bring foreign troops in, which George Bush has now adopted. But, of course, he's incapable of doing because he managed to insult all the people whose help we need on his way into Iraq. So we're not going to get people, leaders around the world who will take risks offending their own population because they all despise the president so much. But with a new American president, I think we will get some cooperation in internationalizing the conflict in Iraq.
If you're in the White House, is that the path that you would take, reach out to other nations and promise to leave within 4 years?
We have to. We have no choice. We can't leave right now because if we do, we've created a huge national security problem for the United States. And if we don't, eventually, we're going to, the whole place is just going to go under. I do think there's one thing I do agree with George Bush about, though. I do think we have to have elections in January, no matter what. For a variety of reasons, we've got to continue to move towards Iraqi control and try to give the Iraqis the possibility that they can control their own show. But right now, that looks increasingly difficult.
Let's look at another big issue, the budget and the balancing the budget. You said in the primaries that you would have taken back all the Bush tax cuts.
Mm-hmm.
John Kerry, of course, is only wants to take back those on households with $200,000 plus income. Is his deficit reduction promise smoke and mirrors? Can he really do it, taking back that much less than you would have?
I think he can. It'll just take longer than it would for me. Look, I know everybody loves tax cuts at election time, but the truth is there's no such thing as a free tax cut. Somebody has to end up paying for that, either in reduced services or bigger debt. This president is the most irresponsible president financially that I've seen in my lifetime. Borrow and spend. Spend money on tax cuts, on war, on whatever you want, and somebody else will pay the bill long after I'm out of office. That's what the Republican philosophy is. I don't think that's good for the country. I don't think tax cuts that can't be paid for are good for the country, and I don't think we should do them.
Is John Kerry being realistic in his formula?
I think he is. I haven't seen his numbers and how they've worked. I never criticize him for the campaign in terms of his willingness to balance the budget. Obviously, it's going to take longer if you leave some of the president's tax cuts, but that's his choice, and that's not a major sticking point.
Howard Dean, you've had months now since your primary campaign came to an end, a lot of time to think about what went on there. What conclusions have you come to looking back on your own effort there?
First is that the American people are fantastic people, conservative, liberal, Democrat, independent, Republican, no matter what ethnic group. The American people are optimistic, good people who just need good leadership. And we all want a lot of things in common, jobs, health care, economic security, a decent public education, a foreign policy that will make us the moral leader of the world again. Those are things everybody wants. I find, frankly, that Republican campaigns are always divisive and always destructive, so that when Republican presidents get into office, they can't be strong presidents. They want a campaign on guns, God, gays, and abortion, and what we need to be talking about in this country is what the best solutions are so that we can resume our rightful role as the moral leader, so we can have a decent health care system and a public education system, and so we can have jobs in America instead of sending them to Brazil and China, which this president seems so intent on doing.
But the Democrats can be pretty tough, too. You remind us that the Democratic Leadership Council sent out a memo calling your campaign, with all of its evident passion, an aberration. Was the Dean campaign an aberration?
I don't think so. I think the Dean campaign has provided an enormous amount of energy to the Democratic Party. Harry Truman once said, if you run a Democrat who's pretending to be a Republican against a Republican, the real Republican will win every time. And I think that's why we're losing so much. We've got to stop pretending we're Republicans and stand up for our core Democratic principles again.
Is that happening? You say that the Democrats have been sweet-talked and bamboozled. They were afraid under the first Bush administration. Have Democrats begun to act like Democrats again,
well,
by your
standard? The 1,000 people that we're running have. You know, I'm really pleased that part of the central part of John Kerry's platform is health insurance for every American. I think that's really important. I'm glad to see John Kerry taking on the president. That's what needs to be done. And I think we have understood that the way to win elections is to get our own people out to vote. The Republicans have been doing this for 20 years. It's why we haven't been doing so well.
But you're talking about a fatal combination of Republican cravenness and Democratic cowardice. Has that cowardice, your word, ended?
Yep. We wouldn't be in Iraq if it weren't for some Democratic votes. We wouldn't have had these enormous tax cuts and huge deficits if it weren't for some Democratic votes. And we've got to stop voting for right-wing extremist agendas and stand up. You know, if you're afraid to lose, you never win.
What's the evidence that that cowardice, again, your word, is over?
I don't know what the evidence is. I mean, we haven't seen the kind of votes to go to Iraq, but of course you're not going to see that. I think we're only going to see that if John Kerry wins, and then we're going to see what direction he takes the country in. The direction he says he's going to take the country in is the right direction as far as I'm concerned. Environmental protection, health care, a different kind of foreign policy that's respectful and internationalist. I'd like to give John Kerry the opportunity to prove that the cowardice is over, and I intend to do everything I can to give him that opportunity because I think he's sincere.
We're talking tonight with former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, former Democratic presidential candidate as well. His new book is You Have the Power, How to Take Back Our Country and Reshape Democracy in America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former Vermont governor and Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean. He's now honorary chairman of Democracy for America, an organization cultivating a grassroots base for the Democratic Party. He's got a new book out, You Have the Power. Governor Dean, I want to ask you about Bill Clinton. You write interestingly about Bill Clinton in the book. You say that in many ways he left a lot of Democrats misled. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think a lot of people got the wrong impression about why Bill Clinton was successful. And it accelerated the tendency of Democrats to run from their own agenda. Bill Clinton was successful. You mentioned the Democratic Leadership Council. They were very busy taking as much credit for that as they could.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, Bill Clinton's success had nothing to do with moving towards the middle. Bill Clinton's success had to do with Bill Clinton being the most extraordinary political figure in this country since Franklin Roosevelt. He is enormously charismatic and enormously politically capable. And what I think the Democrats have decided is that they want to be like Bill Clinton. Well, we can't be like Bill Clinton. There's only one Bill Clinton, and we're not going to see another Bill Clinton for another generation. And so the idea that we're going to succeed by doing what Bill Clinton did misses the point that Bill Clinton was so successful because he was so gifted. We need to be true to ourselves. We need to take that Democratic agenda, which includes a social safety net for seniors and for people who are struggling, which includes worker protection, which includes environmental protection, which includes job opportunities again, and favoring ordinary working people over big corporations as opposed to the opposite, which is what the hallmark of George Bush's administration is. That kind of an agenda makes our base excited and gives them a reason to vote again.
So are you saying that Bill Clinton's centrism is something that the Democratic Party can't successfully wield now, that it has to go back left or progressive, put your own word on it?
Well, I think we have to be careful about saying that. The truth is that Bill Clinton's centrism led to an even more such a centrist approach that there's no center anymore. There's disagreements about how far right you ought to be. Let me give you an example. I balance budgets. I believe in the death penalty in some circumstances. I had 8 consecutive endorsements for the National Rifle Association in all 8 statewide races I ran in Vermont. And yet I was considered the most liberal candidate who had a chance at winning. I was the front runner for a while. Now, if I represent what's liberal in the Democratic Party, there's something really the matter with the Democratic Party. And I think there is. I think the Democrats have failed to put up the kind of debate that needs to happen about where we need to be. And the whole party has moved so far to the right that there isn't any more center. I'm truly a centrist. I mean, I just told you what my record is.
Mm.
I'm very strong on gay rights because I'm strong on civil rights. I believe in health insurance. Everybody under 18 in my state essentially had health insurance. But I also have these other factors. So most people would say I was a centrist, and that's how people thought of me in Vermont. So we've poisoned ourselves by continuing to move to the right without noticing that we've passed the center and become to the right, and we got to go back. And that's why we have trouble getting at our people to vote. That's why people don't vote. We don't give them a reason to vote, and now we're going to change that.
You're very critical of Democrats for letting that happen. You're also very critical in this book, Howard Dean, of the American media. You say it is a failing institution. You're outraged with it. Why?
Well, the media historically, I mean, I grew up in the days of Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, probably two of the icons of American journalism based on having brought down a president and uncovered a well-hidden scandal. That kind of journalism doesn't happen anymore. And I'm not one who believes there's a conspiracy in the media and all that kind of stuff. I think the only media outlet with an agenda is Fox, and clearly they are the unofficial organ of the Republican Party. And I don't think that's so bad. I mean, that's what happens in Europe all the time. It's just that the only thing that's bad about Fox is they don't try to pretend it's not true. But the other media don't have an agenda, I don't believe. Their problem is that they're all owned by big corporations, and the bottom line is very, very important to them. So the news is subverted by the necessity to make money. The danger that Fox poses to America is not that they're right-wingers, which they are. It's that they're very good at what they do. So they've condensed the news to an entertainment medium, and everybody else in the media, including print, is rapidly following them. They want to make their stories exciting, even at the expense of the truth. I actually used the Scream speech as an example of that.
This, of course, your own Iowa speech with the
screen
that was replayed again and again and may have cost you very dearly.
Well, I don't think it cost me at all. I'd already lost the Iowa primary by a lot by then, and it was clear that whoever won the Iowa primary was going to win. But the speech is a great lesson in journalism because the truth is that the speech was nobody in the press bus thought anything of the speech. They'd seen enthusiastic speeches before. It wasn't any big deal to them. They didn't report on it. their editors went crazy the next day because they saw the cable version, which cut out all the sound except for mine from the microphone and didn't show the 1,200 screaming people with American flags. Now, what happened was, so it got reported because the editors in Atlanta and New York and Washington and so forth wanted it reported. But the judgment of the people on the ground was overruled by editors who were controlling content with an eye towards entertainment. That happens again and again and again. There are a lot of examples of that in the book. So you can't just blame all this on reporters and biased reporters and so forth. I think reporters are just like everybody else, is good and bad, just like there's good and bad doctors. But there's a climate in the newsrooms now where there's enormous pressure to put things in the paper that really didn't happen, or substitute judgment of people who weren't there for people of judgment, for the judgment of people who were there. And that's why I think the media is a failing institution, because it's become an entertainment medium first and a news medium second.
You talk a lot about action in this book. If you were in power, what would you do about that media problem as you see it?
Well,
it almost sounds as though you're ready to regulate media.
Well, no, actually, what I would do, you can't regulate the content of the media, not in a country with the first, which depends on the First Amendment. All I want media to do is be responsible. And the only thing we can do as a government is to get rid of all the new rules in the FCC, restore the equal time rules, don't allow anybody to own more than one outlet of any kind in a particular market. You know, there's no news radio in my state anymore. There's only two channels that even have their own, two radio stations in the whole state that have their own reporters. Why? Because they're all owned by these big conglomerates. So the news, when it exists at all, is totally homogenized. That's not good for democracy. You may not be able to make a lot of money in the news, but if you don't do it right, the climate in which your business flourishes begins to suffer. And I think news organizations have an obligation to serve the public by serving them stuff that they may not want. Go ahead and do a 3-minute story instead of a 30-second story. It's not a bad thing for the public to hear that 3 minutes. We can't require that, but we can guarantee that the public's going to have enough choices for them to make their own decisions about what they want to hear. And that means getting rid of all the deregulation stuff that's been done over the last 15 or 20 years and giving ordinary people a chance to hear what's really going on from local news media again.
So you've got a big critique there, and you do bring it down in some ways to what you call the Iowa Scream. You say it provided a classic example of how things can go wrong in American journalism. What lesson did it provide about Howard Dean in your own sense of yourself on the campaign trail?
New, except the people didn't know me. I mean, I'm an enthusiastic person. I've seen that speech, you know, half a dozen times since then. I've kind of enjoyed looking at myself. You know, I'm screaming and yelling. I'm having a great time. It wasn't very presidential, so possibly I could have done something different. But, you know, it really is me. I'm a passionate person, but I'm a fun person. And I had a good time, and so did my supporters, in the face of a very unpleasant and sad event, which is that we got creamed in the Iowa primary. I think it was a pretty human reaction.
And you're saying if people would have heard all the surrounding sound and seen the whole picture, it would not have looked as over the edge as it did when it was isolated.
That's exactly true, and that's why the reporters on the ground thought nothing of it and never wrote about it until they were told to by their editors, because they'd seen me crank up crowds before. And when you're in the context of a room packed with 1,200 people and nobody can hear a word you say, waving American flags, it's a whole different speech than it is when all the sound is filtered out except what you're saying. Look, I'm not saying, oh, the media did me, and this is the standard media stuff. Maybe I should have known that that's what it was going to look like. And I think that was my fault. I probably should have realized I was talking to an entire country and not just the people who came to work so hard for me in Iowa. But what I was trying to point out by using that as an example is, one, it was entertainment, not news, and it was played 600 times on cable the next week as entertainment, which is fine, but it should be labeled as entertainment, not news. And two, and this is the real problem, is the judgment of the reporters on the ground who were there seeing with their own eyes what's going on was overridden by editors and news people from New York who weren't there but who had an eye for entertainment. And that's the fundamental problem with the news media. That's why half of America's young people get their news from The Daily Show and the Internet and not mainstream media.
Governor Dean, let me ask you just on that point. I want to ask
I might add that NPR is still the best news organization in the country.
But let me ask you, there, you don't like the sort of media critique and psychoanalysis of the Howard Dean temperament, but you have described in great detail the challenge that any potential candidate has to go through. That media is there. It exists. And you're a feisty guy. You're sort of a two-fisted, roll-up-the-sleeves way of addressing the issues that confront the country, of addressing the country itself. with that combination, do you have the right temperament? Given the thicket you any candidate has to get to through, do you have the right temperament to be a presidential candidate?
Well, let me answer it this way. I was a doctor and served patients for 11 years, and sometimes in acute emergencies, some people died. I was a governor for 12 years, taking over in a circumstance where the governor died and dropped dead in office, and I had to take over. Yeah, not only do I think I have the temperament, I think I've survived the acid test and proved it. The temperament issue was completely phony. It was dreamed up by one of the spinners from the other campaigns and continuously spun by them in a very charged atmosphere. I was the guy that wasn't supposed to succeed, and I had engendered an enormous amount of resentment from those people who thought they were entitled to the presidency. And that was pure media nonsense and silliness. I mean, I never thought it was a particularly serious issue. But one of my problems is I knew what they were writing was ridiculous, and I didn't pay any attention to it, and I probably should have dealt with it because I think a lot of people did start to believe it.
So you don't think
the electability argument was the one that did me in Iowa. There's no question about that.
Would the Democrats have been better off today if it were Howard Dean who had come out of the primary as the victor?
Always resist that stuff. That's all woulda, coulda, shoulda. I'm not the nominee. John Kerry is the nominee. I'm doing everything I can to get him elected. I think he's a great candidate.
You don't see yourself as the rough and ready truth teller who doesn't actually go the distance. You describe a conversation with Al Gore when he was very important to you in dealing with the kind of end of your campaign. And he said to you, think long term. Keep your eye on where you really want to end up. It sounds to me, Howard Dean, as though you want to run again.
Well, I'm not going to get that far, and if I do, I hope it's not until 2012 after the second term of the Kerry agenda, the Kerry administration. But, and I'm not even going to think about that. I think what Al was really saying, what impressed me so much about Al Gore, is what he was really saying in that conversation is think about what's good for America. Don't just worry about what's good for Howard Dean. Obviously, I wanted to lash out. Then I really was angry. You know, five guys had beat up on me, and they had this secret pack and all this kind of stuff. And I was really, and I was losing, and that never puts you in a good frame of mind. And I was really angry, and I said, Al, why am I a Democrat? Explain to me why I'm a member of this party. And he just basically said, look, this is not about Howard Dean. This is about changing America for the better. This is about changing the presidency because of the terrible things that George Bush has done to this country. The minute he said that, I knew he was right. This is not about Howard Dean. This is not about someday I want to run for office. This is about changing America, and that's why I've worked so hard for John Kerry, because this really is about America, not really about me.
This is on point. Howard Dean, would you accept a position in a Kerry administration if and when there might be a Kerry victory?
Well, I've pretty much resisted even thinking about that or talking about it either. I can remember when I was the front runner, there were a group of people sitting around my office one day when I got off the campaign trail talking about who we should talk to about cabinet positions and who was going to run the convention. Well, people like that end up doing phone interviews with On Point during the convention, during the height of the election season, instead of being in it themselves. So I think it's a huge mistake to even think about who might serve in a Kerry cabinet. And I've totally resisted doing that. I think if there is a Kerry cabinet, then we'll get to that when that happens. But right now, I think the focus has to be on we want to make sure there is a Kerry cabinet before we start dividing up the spoils. I think that's the way to lose elections.
And if you were to do it over again one day, or if you could go back, what would you do differently in your own campaign?
Well, that's also a woulda, coulda, shoulda thing. I mean, where we got in
trouble. But candidates learn, and they act on what they learn, or ideally.
You can't really say, what would you do differently? Because I was a candidate that nobody ever heard of that was a classic insurgent candidate. We ran the insurgency phase great. The problem is I got to be the front runner long before I expected to, and no one in the campaign, including me, was capable of dealing with that. Because running a front runner's campaign is very different than running an insurgency campaign. So in the magical world, if you could, there's a term for the instrument we use in medicine when we talk about this kind of stuff. It's called the retrospectoscope.
Yeah, right.
And it never fails because you always have all the information you didn't have when you were making the decisions at the time, and they turned out to be wrong decisions.
Still, you must have learned things about campaigning.
I've learned an enormous amount of campaigning, enormous amount about campaigning. It's very tough. You know, Winston Churchill once said that democracy is the worst system of government in the world, except for every other. And it's really tough, and you're out there and you're combating each other for the presidency of the United States. But I came away with some real admiration for some of the people I ran against, because they were tough, and they were in the hunt, and we were all tough. I came away with an enormous amount of respect for the American people. And I'm talking about conservatives as well as liberals and Democrats and Republicans, too, every ethnic group. You know, there's an enormous core of strength in this country. I happen to think that people are far better than their leadership right now. I think the leadership is incredibly weak. But I do think that this is a great nation and that we'll rise to greatness on the international scene once again when we get a president who understands what leadership really is.
And what about your core of support, the famous DENIACs?
Well, we're going to do our best to remake the country. And we, as I said, we have 1,000 people running for office, 100 of whom we put on our national list. And so far, we're 1-for-1 in the only election. No, that's not true. We've lost. We've had guys that have lost primaries, but they've done very well, much better than expected. There was a wonderful guy named Jeff Smith, a young 30-some-odd-year-old professor at Washington University who built a huge grassroots organization, just barely lost to a guy who was a very well-known Missouri name in politics and in Congress. And now his whole machine is helping Claire McCaskill, the gubernatorial candidate in Missouri. So, you know, we're going to use our grassroots for constructive ends. We're not going to support Republicans in the Democratic disguise. But we really are going to try to remake the country by supporting good candidates. And when we lose, if the candidates who beat us are good people, as John Kerry is, then we're going to turn around and work very hard for them.
And you say in the book, and perhaps to those followers of yours, you say, don't vote for Ralph Nader. Don't vote, but do listen. What do you mean by that?
Well, Ralph Nader has a wonderful career. There are many things that would never have happened in America had it not been for Ralph Nader. Seatbelts, for one. Much environmental and consumer-oriented legislation. The great tragedy of Ralph Nader, which I've seen even more so since I finished the book, is his total self-destruction in this particular race. I'm one who never begrudged Ralph Nader running in 2000. He didn't know he was going to hand the election to Bush. And he is a principled person, or at least he was. But now he's getting on the ballot with the support of virulent anti-gay groups. The Republicans got him on the ballot in Michigan. He's taking money from Bush's Power Rangers and this stuff. This is not any longer the actions of a principled candidate. This is a candidate who knows that his only chance of getting any publicity is to be on the ballot. And that's why he's at 1% or 2%. And it's just a sad way for him to go, and I wish that he hadn't done it. I think he's at the point now where he's probably not going to take a lot of votes for Kerry. I think most people who know who are sort of on the fence are going to end up voting for Kerry because it's going to be very close, and we do need to get rid of George Bush.
And lastly, Governor Dean, our time is short, but just a few weeks left in this campaign. What's your advice to John Kerry about how to run it?
Well, I generally give that advice privately, not publicly. So, and I've discovered people who give advice publicly don't often get to do it privately anymore. So I won't be answering that question directly. But, you know, I think John would be a far better president than George Bush. I think he's got a lot to say for himself. He's got an inner core of decency and thoughtfulness about public policy. And I think before this election's over, that's going to come out, and John will be the next president.
Howard Dean, thanks so much for joining us
tonight.
Hey,
thanks for having me on.
Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, author of You Have the Power, How to Take Back Our Country and Restore Democracy in America. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Tom.
In a moment, The New Yorker's George Packer on the struggle for Kirkuk. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. According to a new security report out today, this September has been one of the bloodiest, most brutal months in Iraq since the American invasion. More than 2,300 attacks in the past 30 days. Car bombs, rocket-propelled grenades, mortar attacks, landmines, hostages, and beheadings. The attacks are happening all across Iraq, according to the Special Operations Consulting Security Management Group, a private security company that compiled the report as part of its work in Iraq. By its count, not a single province in Iraq escaped attacks in the 30-day period, and that includes oil-rich Kirkuk in the north of Iraq, where a history of ethnic conflict and the fight for Iraq's future run deep. The city is struggling to recover from a long-term program under Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist Party of ethnic cleansing, moving Arabs in and Kurds and Turkomans out. Kirkuk could find resolution. It could also trigger a civil war. George Packer is a correspondent for The New Yorker magazine who recently spent time in Kirkuk. His latest article is The Next Iraqi War. He joins us now from Brooklyn, New York. George Packer, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
You write that in Kirkuk you found what might be the ultimate legacy of Saddam Hussein's rule, in your words, his diabolical revenge on his countrymen. What would that revenge be?
In Kirkuk, it's really an obsession with ethnic power that's the result, really the direct result of a long-term policy that really predated Saddam. It was a Ba'ath Party policy that Saddam inherited and intensified, which was to turn Kirkuk, which had been a city with a long history of multi-ethnicity, into a predominantly Arab city, a city in which Arabs had all the good jobs and in which Arab neighborhoods replaced Kurdish neighborhoods and in which the security of Kirkuk's oil fields was guaranteed by a loyal Arab population. So over decades and decades, the Ba'ath Party gradually changed the demographic balance of Kirkuk in the favor of Arabs. And as a result, now that the Ba'ath Party is no more in Kirkuk, all those ethnic groups with their various grievances are competing for primacy and for control over Kirkuk and its oil fields. And there's precious little ethnic harmony and a lot of ethnic bitterness, and I think we really haven't seen the worst of what Kirkuk probably has to offer.
You describe a kind of dark balancing act going on there, people trying to decide whether to work for a new multi-ethnic future or to sort of go at it hammer and tongs. When you say that Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party program changed the demographic balance in Kirkuk, put some meat on the bones of that for us. This was not an antiseptic procedure.
Right. Well, it was quite a brutal but administratively well-programmed campaign. It did not involve genocide, which the Ba'ath Party did inflict on Kurdish villages in the mountains beyond Kirkuk. But it did involve a deliberate policy of destroying neighborhoods, of loading families into government trucks and dumping them into the Kurdish region to the north, where they became refugees. It involved forcing people who wanted to hold on to government jobs to change their nationality from Turkmen or Kurdish to Arab. It involved really almost an apartheid policy of job discrimination and residential discrimination. And by the end of several decades of Arabization, it involved at least 200,000, perhaps as many as 300,000 Kurds being shipped out of the province of Kirkuk, and a similar number of Arabs being shipped in with the inducements of jobs and free houses and even a cash package. They became known as the 10,000 dinar Arabs because they got that much money as a incentive to come up to Kirkuk.
And since the American overthrow of Saddam Hussein, what has happened in Kirkuk?
Well, the first development was a fairly large Kurdish influx back into the city right on the heels of the American Special Forces who liberated northern Iraq, and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters were with them and, in fact, actually preceded them into Kirkuk. The Americans then tried to establish order. The Kurds seemed to want to grab power and absorb Kirkuk into what they regard as its historical region of origin, Kurdistan. The American forces there began to act as a kind of a buffer and essentially tried to preserve the status quo and not allow property disputes and larger political quarrels to be solved by force. So a year and a half later, what we've got is an American brigade in Kirkuk trying to keep order and trying to build, you know, nascent institutions of self-government. And Arabs, Turkmens, and Kurds partly cooperating but really biding their time and waiting for the moment when essentially there is no more bouncer in the middle of the bar fight, as one soldier said to me, and then making their move for power. And the Kurds especially feel that Kirkuk belongs to Kurdistan, and that the only just solution to the problem there is to reverse the ethnic cleansing, to send the imported Arabs, the 10,000 dinar Arabs, back to the south where they came from, to return all the Kurds who were expelled and their families and descendants back into Kirkuk and the province around it, and then to hold a vote and allow the people of Kirkuk to decide whether they want to join Kurdistan or not.
George Pecker, I wish you'd introduce us to some of the people in the middle of this.
Yeah. Well, this is for me, the really heartbreaking thing about Kirkuk is it's full of quite wonderful people who really do have an idea that their city belongs to all of them and that it's multi-ethnic. For example, maybe the leading character of the piece is a woman named Luna Dawood, who works in the finance department in the city government. And you know, in a way, she was part of the mechanism of ethnic cleansing. She's the person who doled out the cash reimbursements to people who were being kicked out of their houses and forced out of the city. But she had enormous sympathy for the people who were mostly Kurds who she had to do this to. And now she is sort of stuck with the detritus of those years in the form of all these files that she saved. And when the Ba'ath Party ordered the Kirkuk officials to burn all the documents relating to the ethnic cleansing, and she's sort of a one-woman history of those years. And you can just feel the burden of it and the sadness of it and the confusion of what to do now in her voice, and you can see it in her face. She really wants Kirkuk to be a city in which all four groups, Kurds, Turkmens, Arabs, and Christians, she's the latter, can live together. And I also met Kurds who had never left the city all through those years of ethnic cleansing and who now see their lives opening up. They now have opportunities they didn't before, but they also have Arab neighbors and friends, and they are frankly not eager to see them leave the city. And they're Arabs who also have spent their entire lives in Kirkuk, even though their parents were from somewhere else and came up under the Arabization policy. And they too, especially the younger ones, say to me, where are we going to go? We have nowhere else to go. This is our home. And a lot of people suggested to me, if only the politicians would allow it, they could all live together in Kirkuk. But there are strong political forces on all sides that are pushing toward confrontation, pushing the more extreme solutions. And the people of Kirkuk, the ordinary citizens who may want to sort of continue living as they've lived for hundreds of years in a really mixed environment, their voices are sort of drowned out, and the parties are forcing the issue. And so are the people who have not been in Kirkuk this whole time. I found the most militant people are those who have returned to the city after years outside it, rather than those who've lived in the city all along.
You describe an Arab man sitting with some Kurds in Kirkuk, talking together about the problem they now face and sorting out history, how much of this ethnic cleansing in effect they can live with, how much needs to be reversed. And he says, only God and America can solve the problem. How is the U.S. role seen in this knotty problem?
Unlike in the rest of Iraq, in Kirkuk, the American forces are still largely seen as neutral arbiters, as the people in the middle who are trying to preserve order. And so in Kirkuk, the American reputation is a bit better than it is elsewhere in Iraq, where Americans are seen almost entirely as an unwanted occupier and as even as the enemy. In Kirkuk, that's still not quite the case, because it's in the interest of most people in Kirkuk to have a neutral arbiter and enforcer of law to prevent complete chaos from breaking out.
But you describe Kurds as seeing Americans as, in effect, protecting the fruits of Saddam Hussein's ethnic cleansing campaign.
That's
because they don't want the status quo to change. They're saying, don't, Kurdish family, do not move into that Arab family's house where you used to live.
Yeah, that's what's begun to happen. The Kurds, who, of course, are the best friends of the Americans in Iraq, I think expected their agenda to be acted upon pretty quickly, and Kirkuk is really at the top of the Kurdish agenda. The Americans and the Coalition Provisional Authority tried to freeze everything in place until a permanent Iraqi government was around to work out the problem. But by now, the Kurds have grown quite disillusioned, for this and other reasons, with the Americans, and see them as acting essentially to preserve the injustice of ethnic cleansing rather than to undo it. And they've grown very impatient, and there hasn't been enormous violence. I mean, I think most people expected there to be more open conflict by now than there is, but everyone in Kirkuk says that it could happen, and that it could happen at any time, and that when it does happen, or if it does happen, it's going to be intense.
We're talking with George Packer of the New Yorker magazine about his reporting on the tensions just beneath the surface in Kirkuk. This is On Point. George, you say that because the city isn't yet the scene of open combat, it remains what you call a hidden flaw in the broken Iraqi landscape, but that what's a local dispute now between neighbors will soon, in your estimation, become one of the greatest obstacles to making Iraq democratic and keeping it whole. Why? How?
Well, essentially, Kirkuk is where the agendas of Iraq's major ethnic groups come into conflict most openly. The Kurds see Kirkuk as belonging to Kurdistan, and if they make a grab for it along the lines I sketched earlier, It could bring Turkey into Iraq because the Turks regard an oil-rich Kurdistan as a threat with their own Kurdish minority. It could create sort of communal violence on a much larger scale between the cities, Arabs, Kurds, and Turkmens, including Shiite and Sunni populations of Arabs and Turkmens. It's just the city is fractured along so many lines that if the Kurds essentially carry out the plan that all of the Kurdish leaders say they will, it's going to open up enormous fissures between populations that extend throughout Iraq. There will be a reaction in the south. It's quite possible that Kurds in Baghdad will experience reprisals if Kirkuk is absorbed into Kurdistan. And essentially, a country that was cobbled together out of three Ottoman-era provinces, Sunni, Shiite, and Kurdish, and that has had a pretty bad modern history, will be strained, perhaps to the breaking point. And Kirkuk, as one of the CPA officials, Emma Skye, said to me, is where it all meets. It's where it all comes together.
And where so much oil money flows and a lot of tensions, even beyond that, you quote Muqtada al-Sadr saying that the Kurds are Muslim apostates and face damnation. That's hardly the sound of people comfortable living together long term.
Well, the Kurds are seen as friends of the Americans, and the more the insurgency grows and absorbs more numbers of Iraqis into it, the more the Kurds are isolated in Iraq. And the more the Kurds in the north may begin to think Iraq is not a very good bet. It's not a place where we're prepared to make many compromises and sacrifices in order to hold on to national unity. We're going to take what we've got and go away and allow the Arabs in the south to work out their problems. And I think the worse the war grows, the likelier it is that Kurdish leaders are going to stop playing the game of national unity and start playing the game of autonomy leading toward independence. And Kirkuk is really the trigger for that. It's the key to that issue.
And George Pecker, we've just got half a minute left. Do the Kurds have the capacity to take Kirkuk? And what might be the circumstances that would trigger them attempting that?
Well, they outline a legal strategy, a constitutional strategy, a census, a referendum, a vote on the status of Kirkuk. And once 50% or more of the province is Kurdish, they're quite confident that Kirkuk will vote to join Kurdistan. And then the city, which is not 50% Kurdish or wasn't before, will go along with it. And
Kurdistan as part of Iraq or Kurdistan as fully independent, autonomous?
That's a great question. No Kurdish leader these days is talking about independence openly, but it's what every Kurd in the north secretly longs for. And the greater the violence and chaos in the rest of Iraq, the likelier it is that Kurdistan is going to go that route. And the really interesting thing to me is that Iraq is such a mess these days that the Americans can't even pay attention to Kirkuk. It's like we don't even have enough room in our policy brains to pay attention to a place that's quiet right now. And one Kurdish official said to me, they want the calm there, the calm of a cemetery.
George Packer, terrific reporting, and wonderful to hear from you on it. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
George Packer, correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.